It was strange to observe how the behaviour of each side reinforced that of the other. The savage impudence that gradually made it possible for the unpleasant little apostle of hate to assume the proportions of a demon, the bafflement of his tamers, who always realized just too late exactly what it was he was up to, namely when he capped it with something even more outrageous and monstrous. Then, also, the hypnotic trance into which his public fell, succumbing with less and less resistance to the glamour of depravity and the ecstasy of evil. Besides, he promised everything to everybody, which naturally brought him a vast, loose army of followers and voters from among the ignorant, the disappointed, and the dispossessed. That, however, was not decisive. Beyond demagogy and the details of his election manifesto, he made two promises with obvious honesty. The revival of the Great War Game of 1914 to 1918, and a repetition of the triumphal anarchic looting of 1923. In other words, his subsequent foreign policy and economic policy. He did not promise these things in so many words. Sometimes he even pretended to deny them, as he did in his later peace speeches. He was understood all the same. It won him his true disciples, the colonel of the Nazi Party. He appealed to the two great experiences that had marked the younger generation. It was a spark that electrified all those who secretly hankered after these experiences. It excluded those who had written them off and mentally marked them with a minus sign. That is to say, us. We, however, had no alternative party, no banner to carry, no program and no battle cry. Whom could we follow? Apart from the Nazis, who were the favourites, there were the civilized bourgeois reactionaries who clustered round the Stahlhelm, steel helmets, a semi-military nationalist non-Nazi organisation. People who rather vaguely enthused over frontline experiences and German soil and who may not have had the glaring vulgarity of the Nazis, but certainly shared their resentful dimness and their innate hatred of life. Then there were the Social Democrats, beaten even before the battle had started, so frequently had they been discredited. Finally there were the Communists, with their sectarian dogma trailing a comet's tail of defeat. Strange, whatever they undertook, the Communists were always beaten in the end and shot while attempting to escape. That seemed to be a law of nature. Aside from this was the Sphinx-like German army, led by a scheming backroom general, Schleicher, and also the Prussian police, of whom it was said they were a well-trained, reliable Republican force. We heard it, but after everything we had been through, we did not really believe it. Those were the forces in play. The game dragged on, tedious and gloomy, without high spots, without drama, without obvious decisive moments. In many respects, the atmosphere in Germany resembled that which prevails today in Europe as a whole, a passive waiting for the inevitable, still hoping to avoid it up to the last moment. Today, in Europe, it is the war that has so long threatened. Then, in Germany, it was Hitler's seizure of power and the Night of the Long Knives, of which the Nazis spoke in anticipation. Even the details are similar. The slow approach of the dreaded event, the confusion of the forces opposed to it, and their hopeless adherence to the rules of the game, which the enemy daily infringes, the one-sidedness of the contest, the sense of hovering between peace and stability and civil war. There were no barricades, but every day there were meaningless and childish brawls and gunfights, attacks on party offices, and regularly also killings. The mindset of appeasement was also apparent. Powerful groups were in favour of rendering Hitler harmless by giving him responsibility. There were constant political arguments, fruitless and bitter, in cafes and bars, in shops, schools, and in family homes. I should also not forget to mention a new series of numbers games. More or less important elections were always taking place, and now everyone had election results and numbers of seats in their heads. The Nazis constantly gained ground. What was no longer to be found was pleasure in life, amiability, fun, understanding, goodwill, generosity, and a sense of humour. There were few good books being published any more, and certainly no readers. The air in Germany had rapidly become suffocating. It became more and more suffocating until the summer of 1932. Then Brüning fell, overnight and for no reason, and there was the strange Papenschleicher interlude, a government of unknown aristocrats and 6 months of a wild political chase. Footnote. From June to November 1932, Franz von Papen was chancellor. He was succeeded in December by Kurt von Schleicher, whose government lasted until January 30, 1933. Both politicians were authoritarian conservatives. Both thought they could tame Hitler by offering him power. Schleicher was one of the right-wing conservatives murdered on July 30, 1934. The Republic was liquidated, the Constitution suspended, the Reichstag dissolved, re-elected, dissolved again and again re-elected. Newspapers were banned, the Prussian regional government was illegally dismissed, and higher civil servants were replaced, and all this took place in the almost cheerful atmosphere of a final supreme fling. The year 1939 in Europe has much the same feeling as that German summer of 1932. We really were only a hair's breadth from the end. The worst could happen any day. The Nazis already filled the streets with their uniforms, which they were at last officially permitted to wear, already hurled bombs and already drew up their blacklists. In August, the government was already negotiating with Hitler, offering him the vice-chancellorship. And in November, after Papen and Schleicher had quarrelled, the chancellorship itself. All that stood between Hitler and power was the luck of a few aristocratic political gamblers. All serious obstacles had been removed. There was no constitution anymore, no legal guarantees, no republic, nothing. Not even the Prussian police. Just so today. The League of Nations lies moribund. There is no collective security any longer, and treaties and conferences have no value. Spain has fallen, as have Austria and Czechoslovakia. Yet, then, as now, at the very last and most dangerous hour, when all was about to be lost, a pathological, unreasonable optimism seized us, a gambler's optimism, a blithe confidence that we would yet escape the catastrophe by the skin of our teeth. Were not Hitler's coffers empty, then, as today? Were not his former friends at last resolved to put up a fight, as they are today? Had life not returned to the frozen political scene, just as it has in Europe in 1939? Then, as now, we began to toy with the idea that the worst was over.